Hello and welcome to another edition of the End Zone Podcast. My name is Eric Jensen and I have very bad allergies and am dead and am being carried tonight.
Just a lifelong Broncos fan.
By good friends. I was actually in Denver this last weekend. I traveled to Denver to see my beloved Colorado Avalanche lose 7-0 to the Winnipeg Jets. What a disaster of a game that was. It was not pleasant to be in the building for that, but hey, it's always nice to get out to see an Avs game now and again. That is the lovely voice of YB, which haven't seen his lovely face in forever. He's got like this Ringo Starr, like Beatles-esque haircut going on right now. He's just really trying to shag it out, like get grungy with it. He told us beforehand that his barber told him to grow it out because he's going to try something new, and I just can't really wait for the new, fresh, like, faded up, like, sick haircut you're going to show up for when the regular season starts, YB.
Fresh might not be the right word to use considering how old I am.
Yeah, you said grungy, and I immediately had a different vision of what a grungy haircut looks like being.
The final product, the final result of my haircut is to be determined, so.
Well, I will agree with Brian. I describe that poorly. It's not so grungy as it is more like, think Mark Davis.
You used
Davis.
To call it a bowl cut back in the
Mark
day.
Davis.
Mark Davis.
All right, I will not stand for this slander. YB's haircut looks nothing like Mark Davis.
And you're making him sound like he's out here in the like wooded forest hunting for truffles or something.
It's longer on top and there's a very clear undercut on the sides.
That is a very accurate visual description.
And it looks great. YB,
it looks great.
We need to get
much appreciated.
It looks great. You look very handsome. I think
he's got a suit jacket on, got the collar popped. Yeah. He's YB is out here balling.
Of all of us, you probably are dressed the sharpest and look the best. I'm in a Padres.
It is midday,
right now,
so I'll just say.
The Padres hoodie is a very nice touch, I gotta say. And obviously, as a Korean, I have a sort of a rooting interest in the Padres.
Ha-Sung, he's amazing.
Ha-Sung is good, man. That
he's
kid is good.
So good. He's so underrated, too. And we're not going to get into baseball.
Yeah, well, let's not get into that. We can get into that later.
Yeah. The Braves beat the Astros again.
Yeah.
That's all. That's all I have to say.
The baseball conversations, I think, are almost as interesting as the football conversations for this group because we do all come from such different.
I mean, yeah, Eric started off with hockey, and right now I'm mourning the fact that the Red Wings like missed the playoffs because of the arcane rules of the NHL. So, what have you?
Yeah, that was pretty wild. John Tortorella really just screwed you guys, but as he's one to do.
Bro, he got nothing on Angel Hernandez.
Oh yeah, well we don't talk about we try to talk about actual people, not things that have the shape of a human. You know, Tortorella is a human. I'm not sure if I can say the same for Angel Hernandez.
TBH, this is where you've lost me. I don't know who Angel Hernandez
bro.
Is.
Oh, come on.
It's better that
clearly
you don't. It's
doesn't
better that
follow
you don't.
A single baseball account on any of his social media. Not a single one.
I don't really know.
Jed Passan was talking about it on Rich Eisen's show. You didn't even see that clip?
I feel like there's a trolley car problem here with like Angel Hernandez, Scott Foster, and like Oh, I'm trying to think of one of the bad NFL.
Scott Foster. Is that the guy who every Chris Paul?
No, I'm joking.
He's Steratore is great.
Except for the card incident.
Steratore is fine. I can't think of a good NFL example.
The younger hockey league.
Sean.
Sean.
No, Sean's all right. Boger. That's
there
right.
There you go. Jerome Boger. So if the three of them were in a car that was on fire, how quickly would you drive away from the scene?
How quickly would you throw some gasoline on the car?
I would first ask how many games is Angel Hernandez officiating for the other NL East teams? That would be my first question.
Is this like the Scott Foster, Chris Paul like corollary?
Exactly.
You know, Eric, I think we might need to switch the name of this podcast because really the name of the podcast makes it seem very football centric, but I think it's anything but this. So.
Well, it's the off season. That's kind of what I want it to be in the off season. Yeah, but I still am so lost. I haven't looked it up on Twitter yet because I'm trying to be.
Yeah, Google. Well,
Angel
actually, this will
Hernandez
bring up
is
weight.
An umpire.
Well,
yeah,
I was gonna say Angel Hernandez missed calls, but
yeah,
that would be a wealth of results.
yeah,
It's gonna take like 7 minutes to get through.
So just for you, Eric, and anyone who else is illiterate in the world of baseball, he was a home plate umpire for a game. I don't remember who was playing. He called three straight strikes on three very clear balls, like not even anywhere close to the strike zone. Three straight strikes.
Yeah,
I thought in the major leagues we haven't gone to the compete. I thought it was all AI. I thought we had gone to
no, that they're doing that. They're
I think
doing
it's
the minor leagues.
Supplementary. Like they're supplementing the umpires with AI systems slowly. And
only
also,
in the only in the minor
oh,
leagues.
They oh, it's in the minors. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Because
they
they're doing
leagues.
It here in the Korean leagues, and there was a scandal about that. But we will get into that.
Oh, we're international, baby. Let's talk about the international sports.
I think that leads into a good icebreaker question. Which sport do you think is most in need of AI assistance to help in the officiating?
In the officiating?
Mm-hmm.
Soccer.
I think so.
They have the chip and the ball.
I'm assuming that none of you are watching the UFL, right?
No.
I can't. Probably for obvious reasons.
Is this the face of a man who has time to consume other football? No.
Yeah. Well, as you can see by my background, there's not a lot going on in my world where, like, I get distracted by that. Like, I'm distracted from doing that kind of thing. So the UFL has eliminated the chain gang, and they're using.
Really? Have they?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah,
interesting.
They're using a lot of different technology, not just the chip and the ball, because the chip and the ball apparently is not specific enough or
okay.
Hard enough.
Makes sense though. I always thought that
but doesn't the
it
NFL
had some flaws in the system.
The NFL has chips in the chain gang as well.
I believe so.
Yeah,
yeah.
They do.
Yeah. So you can't really see it, but that ball that I'm pointing out in the corner.
Mm. Yeah, I see.
The original Alliance of American Football, that was the very first league to use the chipped balls. So that's a ball that was game used that had the chip pulled out of it. So the bladder inside of it. So I actually got to see it, and they put the chip dead center in the ball.
Mm.
And so the chip would have to cross the line.
Ah, okay, but it has to break
the plane.
Why wouldn't
they
just the nose has to break the plane.
Why wouldn't they put a chip?
Measure, right?
Oh, man.
Because the ball isn't symmetric, because the ball isn't a sphere, so you can't. So, and in soccer, for example, like the entire ball has to cross the line. Same in hockey, the entire puck has to cross the line. But in football, just the nose of the ball breaks the plane and it's a touchdown. Like the rules of line breaks are a little different. So I would assume
well,
that's
also
part of
the
problem.
The shape of the ball, right? If you
right,
put the chip
too.
In the center, assuming all footballs are the same diameter, you can just then measure the distance to each end, right?
Because the ball isn't spherical. So you can't like extrapolate from the location of the chip and kind of measure out the distance. You can't do that with a football.
So why wouldn't we put a chip in either nose?
Well, you'll have to ask Wilson and pass Wilson, I guess.
Price. It's the cost. So those chips only have
right, price probably.
Power. And so that's, I mean, we went through.
Wait, you're telling me the NFL with its billions of dollars does it? Okay.
They didn't grow to have a revenue of $1 billion by spending it on quote unquote frivolous things like
no,
the chips and the balls.
I'm definitely tracking.
So the UFL uses 6 4K cameras to measure for first downs instead of using GPS or any of the other locating actuators. And that has proven to be a lot more accurate in terms of the cameras can get an actual picture on the field with a clarity or I want to say pixelation, but I don't think it really matters with that. But they can do the calculations, and then Blandino just tells the crew.
But is it always 8? I thought 8 was only for playoff games. I think isn't it 4 for just your random 1 o'clock game?
I have no idea. It says here in the article that I'm reading that they use 6. So,
okay, maybe it's 6 for a normal game and 8 for a playoff game.
Possibly.
Yeah, very well could be. So, but it's been successful. And I think that's, you know, to the point of the original question, I think that's where the NFL has struggled the most, right? Is they're, the technology is available. Why are they not implementing it in a lot of these ways? You know, first down cameras or end zone cameras, all that kind of stuff, to where you could get more specific with the calls. But I do think it's an interesting conversation, which sport really needs the most.
I mean, we could go down a rabbit hole about this. Like, I'm not sure if Eric would be up to that, but
so,
we
could go down there's always going to be a large rabbit hole. I don't
Eric's
think
you already checked out and gone to sleep, but, haven't you, buddy?
But going back to the spirit of your question,
I'm still awake.
Ryan,
for the record, still awake.
Because if we're going to be seriously logical about this, sports needs human error, right? There can't be so. We cannot have perfect calls, right? And this is
or
and
perfect
this
athletes.
Correct. So yeah, this is why I think like the way that hockey is officiated is actually really good, because they have the concept of makeup calls in built into the game and everybody understands it, right? It's a known quantity. Now, I'm not saying that will work with every single sport. I don't think it will. I mean, hockey has a very distinct culture that I think lends itself to that style of officiating. So I think if we're considering the spirit of Brian's question, it's not to eliminate human error. It's where are the egregious lapses in officiating that have to be corrected in a vacuum of, or not in a vacuum, but like agreeing that we're not trying to eliminate all errors. Just like this is an egregious one that we have to eliminate. And if I'm considering that, yeah, go ahead, Robbie.
I mean, that leads to a really full, I mean, that goes down deeper into like what is the essence of sports, and also like exactly like if we've accepted human error as part of the game for a long time, but is like some might ask, is that really good for the game? And your opinions may vary on that. You obviously are of the opinion that human error is a necessary and also creates excitement into the game, and which I agree with to an extent. But say, for example, in hockey, like I'm not incredibly familiar with it, but I do know that there have been a lot of like complaints about the offside reviews after like certain goals or so, which are like, this is ridiculous. Like we're not trying to like officiate like a 0.01 millimeter offside to track back an exciting moment. So I agree with you there to an extent. And so I think it's not just a simply a technological issue. It's a philosophical issue, which goes into this and sports as a whole.
Yeah, which, if I were which, to, yeah, sorry, Brian, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, which to your point, I think if it is a philosophical question more so than technology, I think the clear answer is soccer.
Yep, that's why I said soccer in the beginning. So
I would say the last 2 minutes of any NFL playoff mm-hmm. game, mm-hmm. that needs the most attention, because what we should not have is a bad call deciding the outcome of a Super Bowl or a NFC or AFC championship, right, which we've seen. Right, we've seen that happen a couple of times in the past, you know, 5 years.
Logan Wilson is still angry to this day, but I'll leave my Bengals fan out of this.
Like, if I had the power, right, I would kick off a project inside the NFL saying, okay, how can we enable referees in the last 2 minutes of critical games in the playoffs, specifically the playoffs? Like, don't even care about the regular season. Let's just talk about the playoffs. The regular season has, like, if your team loses because of a call, you have time to make up for that by just winning your other games. In the playoffs, it's single elimination. There is no margin for error. So I would say we need to focus on how in the last 2 minutes or the last 5 minutes of any playoff game, how do we enable the referees to, if they've gotten a call wrong, to correct it in real time? Because that's the other problem that the NFL struggles with, right? Any call that's made, you have the attention span of the average football viewer is so small. You're getting the candles being burnt on both ends. They want them to make the right call, but they don't want them to spend a bunch of time making sure they've made the right call. Right.
I'm fairly certain that the fact that people have shorter attention spans is not limited to football fans.
No, I agreed. But it's, yeah. Anyway, so if it were me, I would specifically say NFL football, specifically the last 2 to 5 minutes of any postseason game.
Yeah, I agree with that fact. I feel like putting it into NFL football in those last 2 to 5 minutes of those pivotal postseason games, I think that's a pretty good compromise for Brock, because I do agree that the games themselves need human error, but there should be, you know, the fact that there's not like a sky judge or something like that with some sort of you know, video replay available and AI equipment and things like that. You know, looking at the game is a little bit crazy. I'll just point out this. I think we're getting much closer to the point than people think, though, where a lot of people, like Brian brought this up, are looking at AI more as like a tool to like help humans out with this. Like, I think we're getting pretty close where in like 2 or 3 years, we're going to be able to have programs that like give fairly accurate, not only like analysis of like the rules, but just like analysis of football in general. Is like someone will develop an AI tool for that. And
well, and people are right now. I think, you know, Sam
right.
Schwartz, what is it, Schwartzstein or Schwartzenstein?
Yeah. Big so fantasy guy on Twitter. Yeah.
He does a great job with all of the stuff that he, Schwartzstein, former Stanford Cardinal, does a great job with the analytics side of things and the data analysis side. If you ever watch the Amazon Prime broadcasts.
Oh, that guy. Okay.
Yeah. I think to your point, Eric, it's not about replacing the human being. It's about filling in the gaps where the human being cannot either, you know, like eyeball it. Like, I think that's part of the problem in the NBA, right? Is these guys have gotten so fast and physical and so good at what they do that they just can't see everything, right? And especially with the way officials position themselves on the court and whatnot. And so if you can use those tools, you know, to Brock's point, let's make sure we get everything right in the last 2 minutes and let's not stop the game for an hour to get it done, right? Mm-hmm. Like, those are the two things that we can all agree as sports fans that we really want done. So how do you fill in those gaps with technology? Because I think we get in this mindset of everything should be replaced with technology. And I mean, I don't know about y'all, but I really love listening to a vinyl record because there's a different sound and a different quality and a different.
Well, it's vibe. Like there's a precedent for this, right? We have different overtime rules in the postseason.
Yeah. Yeah. And for a good reason, right? Like it's important to get it right in the postseason in a way that,
yeah,
get by, but also the ties create intrigue and weird little snippets in history that make you look back like the Bengals having so many ties in the last few years is such a weird stat, but also it does play in a factor and it makes the game more memorable. And I think to Brock's point about the human error, the human element, that's part of what makes games more memorable too. That's why the Chris Webber timeout is such a big deal, right? Because it was such a critical mistake and such a critical moment. And you don't see it as much anymore, but it still has to have those elements in order for sports to be fun and entertaining and provide us with the drama that we all seek.
Yep.
And to that extent, Eric, I think maybe now is a good time to talk about the drama of the draft that is upcoming. And
oh, wow.
Caleb,
he's
Williams.
Just putting transition. On a, he's just putting a on a fucking masterclass, folks.
This man's a professional.
I mean, he's just putting on a masterclass. There's no other way around it. That's all it is. It's a podcasting masterclass. I came in here today. I said, "Hey, Brian, I'm feeling under the weather. I'm gonna need you to carry me a little bit." And he's absolutely doing it. He's crushing it out of the park. He's throwing in transitions. He's doing tricks on it. It is incredible. This guy, Brian, what a wonderful transition that is. And so now we get to the portion of the podcast where I want to ask you first about cornerbacks. Very important position for as many premier wide receivers as coming into the game. You know, we talk about this a lot, you and me. Football's about developing answers and coming up with answers to problems. And so I have to ask you this, compared to, you know, the wide receiver class coming in and how deep it is and how much you and RK love these guys, is there comparable play coming in at the defensive side of the ball where there are some guys that can really develop and become answers for these guys that we are projecting to come out and be future stars of the league at wide receiver, guys like, you know, Marvin Harrison Jr. and Romo Dunze and Malik Nabers and all these really intriguing wide receiver prospects. Is cornerback kind of developing the same way this year, or and is it trending in the way where a lot of these corner athletes are getting to the point where they can keep up with the new age wide receiver, or is the wide receiver position still ahead, do you think?
So I think it's a good question, because really when you're building out your draft boards, there are two columns that you're sorting these into, a vertical column and a horizontal column, right? So the vertical column would be all the players that you like, and then the horizontal column would be the positions that matter most on the field. And so I think really how I interpret what you're saying is the value of defensive players, and in specific cornerbacks, when you're great, the value is high. But I think the unique part about this class, especially in comparison to the wide receivers, is a guy like Terrion Arnold, for example, who's one of the highest rated corners in the draft. Is he more valuable than a wide receiver, an offensive lineman, or a quarterback in your horizontal vertical or your horizontal category? And I think that's where maybe this class defensively does not stack up in terms of years past. There aren't absolute studs like Aiden Hutchinson, who are going to be instant impact guys, Sauce Gardner, who is an absolute blanket and a, you know, game changer at the cornerback position. And I think to an extent, because of the influence of the passing game or the throw game, as Eric and I are so conditioned to saying, corners have been devalued a little bit. It used to be that you had a Champ Bailey and that was it, you know. Now I think really what it is it's can you get a corner that plays in your system that will allow you enough coverage time and enough a defensive ability to get home to the quarterback? Because I think that's really where the emphasis of the NFL is these days, is getting pressure and forcing quarterbacks to make mistakes that cornerbacks can capitalize on.
I mean, it seems like we have I think the biggest example would be like cornerbacks are very like scheme, like not scheme reliant, it's not the right word, but they're scheme specific, certain, not with the exception probably like the best of them, they're very scheme specific. So some cornerbacks are very specific towards like press man coverage. Some are more zone oriented, like roaming style players. Some are specifically suited for the slot. Like, and so I think there's a bit more categorization that happens with cornerbacks and the system that your DC like runs and the kinds of players that they require. Like, it's not always that they align with the cornerback prospects that are in the draft pool. So like, and so as like an outsider who knows like general basics of defensive scheming but doesn't really go deep into the woods about it, all you can really do if you're saying like your team needs a cornerback of sorts, is that you think about what kind of scheme that you usually run, and somebody will explain it to you online who's smarter than you are, whether it's like a press scheme or a zone scheme or whatever, and whether you use a two corner or a three corner system, which is now because more nickel is becoming more of the base in NFL schemes because of the prevalence of passing. So okay, like I mean, for example, like in the later rounds, not later rounds, but like second round, like Mike Sanders, like he's not a typical outside corner, like because he's smaller, but you can see like he's like, I think in like older days when the base was more 4-3 and less nickel, guy like Sanders still would be I think lower down because like the value of the slot corner wasn't as big a deal as it is now. Whereas now I think in mock drafts you see Sanders still picked in like the early second round, like high up. Like he's like, I didn't see his testing numbers, so I don't know if he tested like a freak or not, but like those kinds of players who were, I think, undervalued in the past have gone on to like, whereas teams require these types of players. And so if they fall into a certain body type / skill type, then I think the value of a certain cornerback is wildly different from team to team. I think that's a big thing that's happened, especially as the passing game has evolved over the past few years.
I would agree 100% with that analysis. And to your point, you have certain defenses, and I think Seattle's a very interesting example to me, right? Because you've got a new head coach who's likely going to bring in a new schematic defensive system and to what they've been famous for, that Legion of Boom defense with their press man,
Gus Bradley.
And that's, I think, the other part about, to your point, the game has evolved so much away from we're a zone team, we're a man team. You're playing so many hybrid coverages now to try and keep up with the athletes that are out there on the offensive side of the ball. And so because of that, I think a lot of what it comes down to is, you know, how many places can we play this guy? And I think to that point, I think Terry and Arnold, why he's at the place and the position that he is a guy who can move around to a lot of different places and play in a lot of different areas. He does really well in space. He can be a ball hawk. He can play on the outside. He's got that elite size and that strength to be on the outside and still, you know, press up against a wide receiver. But you can also slide him into the slot at that nickel and let him be a force player either in the run game or match up against some of these hybrid tight ends that love to go in the slot. And that's, you know, it used to be that you just had your biggest wide receivers on the outside and your skinny guys on the inside, and that was it. And we're finding now that it's all about matchups in the NFL. And so if you draft a guy like Terry and Arnold, for example, again, you know, ideal size, play speed, instincts, all that kind of stuff, very fluid. He's got plenty of speed. He really has that ability to accelerate when he needs to and break on the ball. He's a good tackler, doesn't really miss in space, but he's not this drool-inspiring prospect that we've seen in years past, right? And I'm trying to think of maybe a decent comp of a guy who's just kind of – I don't know that he'll be an all-pro, but he's also the best quarterback – corner coming from the best cornerback school in the country in Alabama. And so if you're putting him on your horizontal chart, that maybe would bump him up more than, say, like a Fuaga, for example, if you have those two position guys that are sitting there. We just froze Eric on that one.
Yeah, you did freeze me on that one. I was expecting YB to jump back in there.
Well, if you want, I can. But
but no, I thought those were all good points, Brian. I want you to
go ahead. Sorry,
I wanted to ask you about one corner guy I'm pretty fascinated by, who got hurt at the combine, and it feels like he's kind of slid a little bit. What do you think about Nate Wiggins? It feels like to me, the biggest knocks on him are maybe some of the athleticism stuff's not quite there yet. The technique's not quite there, but physically, he's just kind of built like a very high-end NFL number one corner. I wonder what you think about Wiggins and his ability to develop going into the league.
I think his ceiling is extremely high, and maybe that's why his stock has dropped a little bit, is that there is so much room for him to grow as a player. Now, you talk about his athleticism. I think a lot of that is concerns with his ability to really drop his hips and turn and stay in coverage and be a multiple player in a scheme, right? If he was going to Seattle to line up across from why am I blanking on their corner up there? That's Witherspoon, right? That's a great addition for that program, right? Especially if they're going to still do a lot of man press and with that cover three shell over the top, which they can't run it as much anymore because there's just not that many Earl Thomases out there. And really, I think we're starting to understand now just how special that defense was. But even if we didn't know it at the time, my point being, like, he's a bigger physical corner with incredible speed, and he is a very fluid athlete. But he's still really adapting that athleticism and that ability into being a lockdown corner at all phases of the game and all phases on the field. He's not a guy that you're going to think you're going to slide inside. If you're going to do anything, you might drop him back into more of a safety spot as you're rolling coverages. And I think that is there are some tantalizing traits, and I think RK and I both really, really like Wiggins. And anytime RK and I both like a guy, that's been a real positive you know, and we could go back, I think, and probably talk about drafts past and figure it out from there. But for the most part, if a guy fits those needs or has that plus athleticism, which Wiggins does, and he has pretty incredible length at that as well. I think all those kinds of things are factors that to me make his potential as an all pro more tantalizing. However, you've got to get him in your system. You got to make sure that he's going to get developed. And there is that question mark about how many downs out of the game can we use him and how quickly can we plug him in? And so I think that's why his stock has dropped, because really it's one of two things. The way I'm starting to interpret the draft, it's either, is this player a quarterback? You know, if we're designing the flow chart, is player one a quarterback? Yes, draft him. No, you know, like then it's like, okay, who's the most plug and play potential guy at the position? And that's how I think a lot of teams are doing it. And especially because most of the teams that are in the top half of the draft are teams that have been there a lot, that have not won a lot of games and are in desperate need of talent and need it right now and needed to get cooking. So that's the analysis on Wiggins. I love his length, you know, and he also played against some really, really good teams in the sense of like some teams that had some really good wide receivers out there. You know, the Keon Coleman game was fun to watch for sure. So I think there is some of that to where, you know, week in, week out, he didn't have the superstar talent that maybe an SEC school would have that he was going up against. So that can always devalue a guy as well.
I do want to ask something about, because the position we're talking about, like oftentimes, like you hear like term stopwatch position for cornerback, because like the counterpart to a cornerback is a receiver, but a receiver that isn't necessarily like blazing fast or isn't like hulkingly huge can still be successful because you can scheme them up. Whereas cornerback, I think, is less like that, because basically you have to be able to track the guy you're marked with, or your that ball comes into your zone. Like, but nowadays with schemes becoming more diverse and more confusing for the quarterback to read both pre and post snap, like, do you think that's still true? Because so many cornerbacks that we see, like, depending on what the results are at the combine or at the pro day, especially specifically the 40, which I think is seen more for cornerbacks than I think for any other position, because you have to be able to keep up with the guy you're marking. And so do you think the term stopwatch position is now is still relevant to the cornerback, or is it becoming something that you can live with even if you're an NFL team?
I think it's always going to be a position where you're going to have to hit a certain metric, whether it's right. 40 time or, and this is where our conversation about GPS really comes into play. I think GPS game speed has been such a crucial addition, because somebody that's more local to me is Sione Vaki, right? A guy that went both ways for the University of Utah. And you can see his game speed is clearly elite, right? He's pulling away from multiple Washington defenders when he's on offense. So the speed is there. Didn't run a great 40 at the NFL draft. And as I've talked to some guys who do the training for that, some guys who do it for the, you know, the top half of the draft, it's very fascinating to me how much those times play into the draft and the drama of the draft, but have little to no impact when it's time to draft a guy in the room, if that makes sense. And I think Kyle Hamilton's another great example of that, where he didn't run a great 40 time. And it wasn't even like a question mark with Baltimore. They wanted him, and he's turned out to be a really good dude. What I think it comes down to is, does he have, for guys who are stopwatch guys, do they have the mental makeup and the mental ability to put it together that equals it out? And I think that's another part about Wiggins' thing is there are some questions about his ability to release, you know, for a guy who has such great speed, you know, why are you slow to get off your jam sometimes? Why are you peeking in the backfield too much? Is it a maturity thing, or are these legitimate problems where you are showcasing that on the mental processing side of it, you are not up to your athletic ability? And so I think for teams right now, you're in the process of deciding how much of this do we want to risk at what position. And to Eric's point again, that's why you're starting to see his stock drop a little bit. But there's going to be some team out there that's just going to fall in love with the measurables. because they're fantastic. And, you know, I think there are really reliable corner prospects. I mean, we talked about Terrion Arnold, and Cooley McKinstry is another guy. He's that good, you know, to where you can plug and play and kind of forget about him. But it's for these teams like, oh, I think the Washington Redskins might be a good example, where if you can get him early in the second round, that's a great position to get that kind of a guy, because he has the potential to be a Pro Bowler. He has the potential to be an All-Pro guy. And so maybe that's where you'd rather take the risk on him instead of taking it in the first round. And to your, you know, just real quick, this the thought of like the measurable guys, there are some positions where it's just absolutely crucial. I think it's corner. I think it's defensive end. I think everywhere else it's kind of negligible. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need a quarterback that's a huge measurable guy unless it's, you know, Josh Allen, right, where his measurables are just so off the chart because he's an enormous human being. He's just never going to get hurt. So it's an interesting question, because I think that's always – fans always love the players that kind of buck the measurables and come through. But even Cooper Kupp was a guy that his – I think it was his 10-second split was unbelievable and off the charts. Yeah. And that's
still like top 10 combine history, like something like that.
So it's like he's not this great white hope that's out there lumbering around like some Sasquatch in the forest, right? Like, he's a legitimate athlete. And
I mean there's another great white hope at the cornerback position this year, like Cooper DeJean. So but he's a freak athlete too. So
yeah, when Dominic Foxworth is championing a guy, that's when you know that like everybody is on board for Cooper DeJean to break the cycle.
I mean, what's who like Harrison Smith? Is that the closest thing to a DB that we have in to a white DB that out there right now?
White DB, good question. Let me think about that for a second.
That's not really a list that I keep track of. But...
No, I mean, me neither.
I mean, the last out and out corner was obviously Jason Sehorn, but that's a long time ago. And
the other even
Harrison Smith, as good as he is, he's a safety.
Yeah. Eric Weddle was another safety.
Eric Weddle, that's the other
Eric
one.
Eric Weddle, yeah, that's fair.
But that's kind of it, right? Like, there's not a lot of
in recent years, yeah, definitely.
Most
of
those guys that are really, really good safeties usually end up at linebackers or something like that eventually, because
Luke.
Yeah.
Keekly. Retired too soon.
Mm-hmm. If only they'd invented the Q color a few years before.
Yeah.
Eric, who else?
We lost a couple of good linebackers, like early. Keekly, Patrick Willis,
yeah.
The one from Wisconsin, too. I'm trying to remember his name.
Chris Borland.
Yeah.
To me, the guys that I'd like to hear a little bit more about from you, and I may have missed one of them earlier on. We talked about Terrion Arnold a little bit, but Kool-Aid McKinstry to me is a guy that I've done a little bit of tape watching on myself, and he's a guy that I think he's the Alabama corner that I would target. I like him. He doesn't necessarily have a ton of like quick twitch, which I guess NFL scouts would call, and that could maybe hurt you at the next level, but he's, you know, a very solid and just kind of smooth corner. He mirrors wide receivers' routes well, and I feel like that's important to have, and using him as like kind of a nickel guy would, I feel like, be a good good kind of position for him. And then Quinyon Mitchell, I'm just curious as to how you think that's going to play out. It seems like everyone really, really likes him. It seems like if you hear from DJ and from NFL front offices and stuff like that, people really like Quinyon Mitchell. My question for you is, how much of a learning curve is there going to be for a guy like that who's coming out of a MAC and going basically directly to the highest level of football in the nation?
What's MAC?
The Mid-American Conference.
Thank you.
Which is where Toledo plays.
Also known as the greatest midweek conference in the country.
Hey, you've never heard of MAC, Rock?
Maction.
I actually have heard of Mac, but it's not like I'm tracking its definition right. and context.
Gotcha. Okay, no worries. No, Maction's great. If you're ever just bored on like a Wednesday night in November, there's always some action on if you need a little football fix midweek.
Yeah, not since my first child was born have I ever had that kind of time.
I was going to say, maybe if you had a baby in like September, some late night meetings would be, you know, in the cards for you with some action.
But the latest any of my children was born is March. So SOL on that front. No, I'm sorry, June. I have a June. I'm sorry. I lose track.
That's an ultimate dad moment. Yeah.
That's a recordable moment right there.
Yeah, I think to your question, Eric, I think it's less about the mental side of it in terms of learning schemes and everything like that, because everybody everywhere is playing the same stuff. And so really what it comes down to is, can you hang in there mentally and have the mental tenacity and toughness when you're going up against the best wide receiver that you saw all season in the MAC every single game and every single play? Right. And so that really, I think, is the bigger concern for me when I look at those guys. It's because every guy has physical traits. Every guy has technique and ability. And there's not really that much difference in terms of, you know, you can go to a school and get coached up well. And sometimes it's a bit of a rarity. But for the most part, good coaches are out there at a lot of different schools. There's just so many factors that go into it that are beyond coaching control in terms of player development. You know, when does the light bulb really go off for a guy? I think what's really tantalizing about Mitchell is he has some incredible ball skills and some ability to really go after some passes. So how much does that burn him at the next level in the NFL? Because that's I think the more that I watch the NFL, the more I learn. It's how much can you minimize the risk on certain plays and how well can you time them so that you're making you're taking your risk or your gamble right at the moment that you need to take it. And so I think that's where he has to develop, where it becomes less about in the film room in terms of learning the scheme and everything like that, but knowing and learning when the time to take a risk or try to go after a ball comes and when to leave it alone. And that's just going to take some playing experience, to be honest with you.
I'm sorry, Brian.
I think that's why he's at where he's at, you know, and the small school guys always kind of get a little bit of that. But we've seen, you know, even players like Khalil Mack, where even when he's coming from a small school, they are capable of big things.
Would y'all say, outside of offensive line, the most important assistant coaching position is DB's coach? Does it play that big of a role in the development of these, maybe smaller school or later round DBs? Because I feel like there are coaches out there that can take somebody with raw ability and coach them up to a point where they can be elite. Like I think of Josh Norman, right? And when he was in Carolina, and I'm not denying his talent or anything, but he achieved a certain level of ability that I don't think he ever really reproduced elsewhere with any other coaching staff.
Yeah, I'll let Brian take this one. I think that's an excellent question for the person here who has actually played football at a collegiate level.
I think it's scheme dependent. You know, I think it depends a lot on who the defensive coordinator is. Because if your defensive coordinator is a guy with a history with defensive linemen or defensive lineman background, that's going to be the basis for your scheme, right? So in the course of becoming a defensive coordinator, a lot of coaches will work with a lot of different positions. And if you're under a really good DC, he'll put you in different rooms at different times to really develop and learn, especially if you're coming up as like a quality control or an off-field assistant. That's when you really develop all that. And I think that's where you look at what the Commanders had. It's still Freudian slip that I don't know why. Probably because it's a terrible football name. what the Commanders
they should
have
stuck with the Washington football team. The
Washington football team is great. And we're left alone. But when they had McVay and Shanahan and all those guys in the room together as off-field assistants.
McDaniels.
Talking, yeah. McDaniel. And they're sitting there talking through stuff and coming up with these concepts and challenging each other. That's where the growth really comes. I think repetition and to your point, Brock, at lower levels, it's about scouting to see what a guy could be or seeing guys that aren't corners that can play corner, right? Mm-hmm. So the University of Utah has made their, you know, made their living off of that for almost 20 years now, where they've robbed the offense to pay the defense. And granted, it's netted them two Pac-12 championships. They've finally gotten to the point now where they've had to recruit wide receivers and keep them at wide receiver. But I think, so the original question, I think it's so scheme specific, because you talk about an offensive line coach being important. I actually think the most important assistant coach is an offensive coordinator, because they're doing the play calling. They're setting the game plan up. You know, I think defensive guys, their job is different in the sense that they don't have to start the fight. They just have to finish it. Hmm. And sometimes I think it's easier to go, okay, they want to do this. We're going to counter with that. You know what I mean? Especially, and that's where you see in-game adjustments happening. You know, most of these guys and you know, the analytics and everything else have made it to the point to where everybody kind of knows what everybody's going to do. So it just comes down to the little nuance during the game. And how are you changing, you know, your base stuff in just this little incremental way to confuse another team? But I think this is getting a little long-winded, but I think,
well, I'm going to ask a follow-up that has nothing to do with this topic, because I'm interested by your answer. So do you, cause you said defensive coaches typically are reactive, not proactive. Are coaches like Steve Spagnuolo or Lou Amorino different in the way that they are attacking the offense, in the sense that they come with these exotic blitz or exotic pressures or exotic looks that actually puts them in a more proactive position as opposed to reactive for the defense?
So that's a good question, but I think it's a really good question, because I think what we're thinking of is Spags coming in every week and saying, this is what we're going to do. We're going to blitz the heck out of them on third down. We're going to do it this way. That's him all the time. It doesn't matter the program, right? Where the adjustments come in is in terms of the team starting off with their first 15 or their initial script and seeing what it is that they've looked at on the defensive side that they've decided to take away or to attack, right, as an offensive unit. And the defense thinking, okay, they're either playing into our hands or we need to make an adjustment, right? And so to your point, I think some of those guys – are almost so self-aware of their own defense that they build their game plans every week to eliminate whatever it is that you might be seeing. And I think you saw that in the Super Bowl with Spags, where he moved some guys around and did some things with some personnel that we really hadn't seen. And he kind of did it all throughout the playoffs, but we get so enamored by Mahomes and everything else that we overlooked that defense for so long. And it's such an interesting transition, because they sucked in that opening game against Detroit, right? And then it was, okay, Chris Jones, we know your worth, come on back, let's give you all the monies. Oh, and then from there they just kind of flourished and continued to build and develop. But I think defenses, it's this never-ending game of chess, where a defense is always going to attack your weakest spot as an offense, but on the offense you have to be the initiator, because you're the one that's running the play trying to score. Right. And the defense is the one that's trying to stop you. So to a degree, just because, you know, the aggressor is normally on offense, I think a lot of those guys are more akin to coming in and setting the tone initially with some of their schematics and what their game plan is. But I think really what makes a great defensive coordinator is plan A is this. Plan B is this. And if you have a great plan A and a plan B, those are the guys that really have success. And I think a lot of times it's the guys that miss on plan A, don't have a plan B or don't have a good plan B that you see flop and flail and everything like that. They're all aggressive to a degree, but I think guys just have different philosophies.
That's what separates though the great DCs from the just good ones, because there's good ones that are really good at prepping, maybe not so good at end game, and then, you know, vice versa. Like, I think in a ideal world, you want your DC to be able to do both. Really good at prep, really good at adjustment. But I think your my original question, your original answer is it's scheme dependent. And so, like, I think that kind of, to bring it back to the draft, right? The GM is the one picking the players in most cases. How do they account for finding guys that fit the scheme, whether it's offense or defense, right? Like, how much football knowledge does the GM have to be able to, you know, talk to the DC or talk to the OC or talk to the head coach and be like, hey, here's this guy, here's his traits. We think he fits the scheme in this way. Like, because that's the GM's job. They have to give them players that will work with their scheme that they can coach up and make the team better. I think, I don't know, maybe this is just such a simple point, but like, that's something that I feel like maybe we don't give enough thought to. Like, you have to fundamentally understand the kind of scheme your coaches are trying to implement to be able to draft the right players on some level. And there's some guys who just, they're the talent transcends, like Marvin Harrison, for example, Junior, for example.
Ideally, like, because like, as you mentioned, the GM is like, along with the head coach, kind of like the two main, like boss figures in an organization, owner, like if you exclude the owner. And the GM, like, he may come from a football background. He may come from a bit of more of a business background, like, because the GM's duties like go beyond like forming a roster. Like, he has to operate the non like playing side of the game as well. But like, I think it's the same with like any leadership role. Like, if you have experience in the football and the schematics and the specific technical know-hows of it, then obviously you're a bit more well equipped to handle, like, if your defensive coordinator or your head coach or your OC comes up and says, like, because we're running this and this sort of scheme, like, this sort of players who we're looking for. And then, like, odds are the scouts or the personnel director, like, kind of writes up like opinions on the various prospects that are in the pool and gives their recommendation, which obviously the GM is free to take or ignore because that is the boss's prerogative. But the ideal scenario, like, in the workings of an organization, is that if the GM, like, regardless of the GM's like knowledge level in the technical, like the schematic and technical aspects of football, like, he incorporates the feedback that he gets from his coaches and his scouts and his personnel people. And then, like, I don't think the GM has a unilateral like prerogative to draft a certain player. Like, otherwise the coach would probably fight the GM like live on draft day. Like, you saw it happen basically when Mike Vrabel walked out of the press room after he learned that AJ Brown got traded. So, like, that falls on the GM, that falls on the coach, obviously, and also that falls on the owner, because the owner is the one that has to coordinate like the dynamic between the GM and the coach. Like, ideally, you want those two to kind of hash it out like responsible adults and whatnot, but life isn't always perfect. So,
there's a couple things that come to my mind with that question, and I think YB makes a really good point that it's about finding that middle ground between the GM and the coach. One thing about coaches, they always think that they can coach a guy up.
Yeah.
Get the job done.
I can fix that guy.
Yep. I love this guy's intangibles. Give him to me, we'll make him a perfect press corner. And it's like, and this is where I think, so have any of you ever played the game Football Manager before?
Of course.
Okay, yeah.
Religiously.
I don't like the way YB said, of course. Now I feel bad.
Okay, well.
I didn't even know that game existed.
Part of it is, I think our American upbringing does not make us as.
Oh, football is in football?
Yes.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Beautiful game. The beautiful game.
The beautiful game, yeah.
Yeah. And so I didn't know the game existed until about a week or two ago when I listened to the Pablo Torre.
So you like Pablo Torre? Okay.
Yep.
Wow, I've been exposed as not a consumer of Pablo Torre.
That's okay, bro. Again, we've made the point that you have children and an actual wife and are not just walking around listening to podcasts. To the point of that, I think the really unique part about Football Manager is the way that because we all love doing the scouting stuff, right? And then you know, I kind of feel bad because every time we get on here and Eric's like, all right, give a scouting report on this guy. And it's like, I could literally read DJ's scouting report and it would be better than anything I could ever come up with, right? But I think what's really cool about this modern era, and the smart GMs will do this, you have thousands of people out there that are watching the tape, checking all these things out, right? And scouting these players. So I think you can come to a consensus of like, we have all these data points. Let's analyze as many of them as possible so we really understand who this player is. And then let's dig in and figure out the specifics that matter. And I'll give you an example here. There's a player at the University of Utah. His name is I'm blanking on it now. He was a tackle. Started out at guard, then he moved to tackle. And he was on the right side and really, really struggled. Darren Paulo is his name. So he played it with the Broncos at one point in time, kind of Detroit, has bounced up and down the league, never really stuck anywhere. Struggled a little bit at right tackle. And sure enough, spring, I see him move over left, and I'm like, that's a terrible decision. Like, he is not good enough to play left tackle. I saw him at right. He really struggled. They stand by it. He shows up in fall, first game, knocks it out of the park at left tackle. And I'm just like, wow, he must have made some serious progress. Up there talking to the coaching staff, I'm like, yeah, so tell me about Darren Paulo. He's really put in some work. And they're like, yeah, he's done well, you know, but we expected this out of him because he's left-handed. And that was it. They just moved him to the side that was his natural hand side, and all of a sudden everything fell into place. And it was like, it wasn't because he developed all this much or played anybody. They just figured out that he was left-handed. And so to your point, that's the job of the GM. Figure out what hand it is that's going to make this player into what you need him to be, right? And then, you know, you're collecting data points with the coaches and everything like that. Then you can give the player to the coaches. The coaches are happy because they know for a fact what's good and what's not good about this player, what the keys are. And so I think the great scouting departments are the ones that can figure out those little knickknacks, and the great GMs are the ones who can see or do the research or have the relationships to where they know that, hey, Puka Nacua was a 4-star verging on a 5-star wide receiver. He just got real homesick at Washington, wanted to come back to Utah, and he didn't have the talent around him at BYU to be the kind of player that he really is. Take a chance on this guy because it's going to pay off, right? And I think a lot of times it's just luck. You just know somebody that knows a kid's background, or a scout has a connection with somebody that has it. And so in terms of like picking guys based on your scheme, I think there's danger in that. I really do. Just in the sense that like coaches need to be challenged. If they just show up and they just do the job because they know a guy can already do something, that leads to complacency, whether they want to admit it or not. They're human beings. It just is out there. And so if you give guys, you know, I have a friend who's coaching New Mexico State. He's got this guy who's 6'8". He's Navajo, and he's going to be, you know, a day two, day three draft pick at some point in time. But the kid had never played football before. And so that was his challenge, was taking this elite athlete that has not been around football, has not really, you know, had the typical background or come up ways that we tend to believe are the ways to develop, and turn him into a left tackle. And the kid's phenomenal. Shaz Pete is his name. You know, you'll see him a lot next year or the year after, depending on, you know, if he has a successful season. So that's where I think sometimes as a GM, you have to be willing to almost hold coaches accountable to doing their jobs and say, hey, we got the guy that we think has the best ceiling to do this. He's going to be your challenge, right? But I think for coaches, when you get the right guys in there and you have the right information, that's the kind of challenge that they excel with. And I think that's where you really create that synergy and trust, you know?
Synergy, trust.
Breaking down prospects. I apologize.
And I will say this. Honestly, you put this out. It's my fault. It's fucking my fault that the Broncos are this dog shit. It's because George Payton has been listening for my draft advice this entire time. He's just been tuning into the End Zone podcast as a regular listener, and he's like, dude, this kid out of Salt Lake City, he really knows his shit. Like, RK's really got his shit down, and I bet he's listening to you this year. And that's why he's so fucking terrible at his job. He's been listening to us amateur football podcasters instead of trusting the scouts within his building. And now I feel worse because I guess I'm the reason the Broncos suck.
This is what you wanted, right? You wanted the platform. You wanted the microphone. You got it. But I will say this. You are just one dot on a major plot.
Right. So. Right.
Maybe a big dot. I don't know. Maybe he's got us highlighted because.
Yeah, maybe George Payton's all up. Dude, do you think Sean Payton listens to this podcast? YB, for real? I think
Sean Payton might be listening. We should check Eric's phone one day. Like, he has like Sean Payton, George Payton, and all the Broncos coaches on speed dial on his mobile. Like, we were duped without
I've
like
been
without
the shadow GM this whole time.
And that's the only reason why George Payton hasn't been fired, because he's the one pulling the strings in the background.
Yeah, that would explain a lot.
Eric's phone has like secret phishing code embedded into it where it's just right. Information and listening to him all the time.
All right.
Well, more reasons for AI to saturate the game.
Yes. I wanted to keep this one more manageable. So I think we're going to wrap up here because we've been going long with these. Here's what we're going to do next week. next Wednesday, hopefully, we can get as many people involved as possible. We are going to do a big first round mock draft. It'll be every single team. We'll break down every single pick. The players that we have not mentioned in these draft breakdowns. I've been looking at first round mock drafts over the last few days. My biggest goal with this draft season lead up stuff is just to get everyone familiar with the names you're going to hear on night one, most of them. And I feel like we've done a good job on hitting on all of them, except the 2 to 3 defensive tackles that might be taken in the first round. We'll talk about those when they go off a board. And a favorite prospect of mine and a guy I've just been on for about the past 2 years in Brock Bowers, who I want to obviously have a little bit more of a discussion about as well. But we're going to leave it at that for tonight. YB, thank you so much for joining us. Always nice to hear from you. Brian, thank you for the deep insights on coaching and the way football is played and analyzed. It's always fun to have those deeper conversations here in the off season with more nuance. I always appreciate having those on this podcast. Brock, thank you for helping carry us this evening. And to the listeners, sorry that you didn't hear from me too much this episode. I am dying inside. But I also just enjoyed listening to that conversation between three football minds that are much smarter than my own. So hopefully people came away with some good takeaways.
If I could just interject, because that was a beautiful outro, and I apologize for doing it, but as someone who sat in on meetings for a professional football franchise with Randy Mueller and Dennis Erickson, this is a lot of what the conversations are like. And this is why these jobs are just absolutely coveted by these dudes, and why, you know, I don't know if any of y'all saw Steve Kerr's press conferences where he said, this is why I'm addicted to the sport, right? This is the addiction, because it is not about the football knowledge as much as it is problem solving. And Brock, he's over here like waving his hand, like, oh, football knowledge, whatever. You ask incredible questions. And that, like that sometimes I think is as synergistic as anything in the room. So I hope Sean Payton is listening to this, because we did a really good job tonight of asking the questions and talking it out. And I think sometimes that's a little more interesting in terms of debating a prospect rather than just saying like, okay, the guy does this, he doesn't do that. Where do we put him on the board, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all trying to learn. And that's why I asked those questions, right? Because I actually wanted to know the answer.
Yeah,
the best way to learn, to ask the questions.
Yeah, well, and to the point, like, it's not about who has the most knowledge in the room. It's about discussion. I think that's the really important part. And the teams that are really good at that and identifying the factors. And you know, some of it is just I listen to a lot of these guys talk. Some of it is I've done it. I've coached at high school level. I've done a lot of player evaluation for recruiting services. So my background is heavy in that. And, you know, so I think that, you know, yeah, that is the unique part about football. It doesn't matter how much, you know, we can all talk about it and have a good time. And indeed, you can have a good time listening to the End Zone podcast on whatever podcast platform you may subscribe or follow at any time.
What a landing.
Amazing. It's dark in here, but I'm raising the roof. He landed the plane. That's all I wanted. But big round
Eric
of applause.
Never hypes up podcasts in that way. Eric, you should take notes. You need to do that.
Yeah, yeah. You definitely, it was, I definitely could. I'm my own worst marketing enemy. But yes, do check out the podcast on Twitter at End Zone Pod. Do follow us on Twitter at Brown Bear SLC and at Eric 18 Utah, and I'll keep you too anonymous as you would like to be, or you may share whatever you would like to share.
Be anonymous. Just do it.
Until next week for our official End Zone podcast first round mock draft on Wednesday night, the night before the draft.